So you can enter questions there on the left-hand side, and we can all see them. That's a good way to sort of, if you think of a question, to sort of quickly note it down, and then hopefully we'll get to it in the discussion and answer, question and answer session at the end. I think with that, I'll hand you back to Gus.
Yes, just one question. Does everybody see the questions, Rebecca, or does only Kevin see them? I'm not clear on this.
I think anybody who is given a chair role on the okay. on the system will see them.
You won't automatically see your own questions, but I should see them, and Kevin will see them, and we will sort of ask them on your behalf, as it were. Okay.
Yes.
That's the way it works.
And you can also email either of us if the details of Gus's email were on the station.
Yes, that's gus@nam.org.uk.
Great.
Okay, right. We're a minute ahead of schedule. Brilliant. I'm going to introduce Mitzi Gafos. Mitzi is a social scientist in sexual health and HIV prevention research at the Medical Research Council Clinical Trials Unit in London. And she's the social scientist on the PROUD study, which she will be telling you about. And one part of her work is supporting the PROUD Community Engagement Group and the participant involvement activities, and that's also how I it's one of the ways I got in contact with Greg. I've known Mrs. Worth for quite a while when she was working on the big microbicide trial in South Africa, NDP-301, and so she's got she's a very experienced social scientist working in prevention for quite a while. So Mitzi will talk about where we are at this very exciting juncture in the PROUD trial, and we'll give you some background into the study too. So Mitzi, if you press *7, please present to us.
Thanks, Gus. Good afternoon, everybody. So as Gus said, I'm going to give you an overview of the PROUD pilot study looking at PrEP in the UK. I want to start with the first slide. Next, please, Kevin. To just remind us all where we're up to in terms of the evidence around oral PrEP to date. The Partners PrEP study showed a 75% reduction in risk with daily Truvada among serodiscordant couples in East Africa and a 67% reduction in risk with daily tenofovir. The TDF2 study in Botswana showed a 62% reduction in risk with daily Truvada among heterosexual women and men in Botswana. And the Bangkok study showed a 49% reduction with daily tenofovir among intravenous drug users. The first study that reported was actually the IPREC study that showed a 44% reduction with daily Truvada among gay men, other men who have sex with men, and transgender women in the Americas, Thailand, and South Africa. And then there were two studies, FemPrep and Voice, which showed no effect with daily Truvada or tenofovir among heterosexual women in East and Southern Africa. And that lack of effect has very much been explained by the very low levels of adherence observed within that study, with less than a third of participants taking the drugs regularly. So there's a very clear line between adherence to these products and effect size. Next, please. So the IPREC study results came out in the late 2010, and in early 2011, the professional bodies that deal with sexual health in the UK, the British HIV Association and the British Association of Sexual Health and HIV, agreed that they needed to release a position statement on the need of PrEP in the UK. They did that in consultation with a range of community organisations, healthcare providers, health commissioners and researchers. They reviewed the literature and agreed that there was a need for evidence on the value of PrEP in the UK. And some of the outstanding questions related to cost, not only of drug, but also of delivery, of issues around resistance, concerns about toxicity, and around understanding the impact that PrEP may have on people's risk behavior and whether it increased other risk activities. So the position statement recommended that ad hoc prescribing of PrEP be avoided and that PrEP be prescribed in the context of a clinical research study in order to collect the UK-specific evidence as quickly as possible. Next. So the PROUD pilot study was developed as a result of that consultation, and this was an open-label study randomizing individuals to immediate or deferred use of daily Truvada. Next, please. The study was designed to enroll about 500 gay men who had reported unprotected anal intercourse in the last 90 days and expected to have the same again in the next 90 days, that were 18 years and above and willing to take a pill. Participants were randomized to receive Truvada immediately or to wait 12 months and be followed up in the study to then receive Truvada. This gave a comparison between those two groups. Participants were followed up every 3 months for a total of 24 months with an extra visit 1 month after starting drug for an extra safety evaluation. This was designed as a pilot study. Our assumption was that we would need a far larger clinical trial to be able to get an estimate of effectiveness in this population. So the outcome of this was really to understand whether it was feasible to do a larger trial. However, as I'm sure many of you have seen, in early October, our Independent Data Monitoring Committee looked at this data and saw that Truvada was highly effective even in this very small study population, so much so that they recommended that we stop the deferred group and anybody who was not yet being offered Truvada be offered it immediately. They also recommended that instead of finishing people's follow-up after 2 years, we continue everybody on with access to Truvada in follow-up until the very end of the study, which would be April 2016. So we're now in the process of offering all participants access to Truvada and inviting all participants to return for STI and HIV testing so as we can get a final measure of effectiveness that we aim to release in the first quarter of next year. Next, please. So what I'm going to do in this presentation is give you an overview of the sexual behavior profile of the participants who enrolled in the study. And to some extent, this helps to explain how we've been able to answer a question around effectiveness in such a small population. So we enrolled from November 2012 to April 2014 at 13 sexual health clinics across England, 8 in London and 5 outside. Volunteers who joined the study were asked to complete a paper questionnaire about their demographics and sexual behaviour, and the data was analysed in Stata. Next, please. The participants who, so in total we enrolled 545 participants, but we had data in the database for 535 when we did this analysis. And participants were a median age of 35, the majority were white, UK-born, university-educated, employed, self-identified as gay or homosexual, and were not in an ongoing relationship, but about 30% were living with a partner at the time they joined the study. Next, please. At enrollment, 73% reported using recreational drugs in the last 3 months, and of note, 43% of those reported using GHB, crystal meth, or methadone, the three drugs most commonly associated with chemsex, although we didn't specifically ask about drug use at time of sex. At enrollment, participants reported visiting clinics an average of 3 times in the last year for HIV testing and 3 times for STI testing. 36% of them reported using post-exposure prophylaxis in the last year, which is freely available through sexual health clinics in the UK. And 14% reported using PEP more than once in the last year. One of the criteria for joining the study was, as I said, that people were having condomless anal sex, and the reported rates of sexually transmitted infections in the year before joining the study were staggeringly high, at 64% of participants reporting at least one STI. Next, please. When they enrolled, participants reported a median of 10 anal sex partners in the last 90 days, but the majority of those partners were with a condom. A median of 2 partners were without a condom when the participant was the receptive partner, and a median of 2 when the participant was the insertive partner. The majority of the partners in the last 90 days were new, so 7 new partners that the participants had not had sex with previously. Next, please. We asked participants to report all of the reasons for not using a condom the last time they had condomless anal sex. So the percentages on this slide are percentages of responses. So an individual could tick many different options. And not surprisingly, the main reasons people didn't use condoms was because condom reduced sexual pleasure, or they or their partner did not like condoms. Next, please. We also asked participants what they thought the HIV status was of the person they last had condomless anal sex with. And you can see here in the red that just under half, 45%, thought that that partner was HIV negative. In the green, 28% thought the partner was HIV positive and on treatment. But of note, 22% did not know the HIV status of their last condomless sex partner. Next, please. Again, we asked participants to tick a range of options around the risk reduction strategies that they were using before joining the study. And the most common responses were around condom use, 40% responses around the participant using condoms, 26% about asking partners to use condoms. And the second main group was sero sorting or strategic positioning, so 38% choosing a negative partner, 26% choosing a positive partner on treatment, and 30% choosing to be the insertive instead of the receptive partner. Now, more than 50% of participants reported more than one strategy, and when we looked at the combination of strategies, there really was a polarization between these two groups. So people either reported condoms or sero sorting or strategic positioning. Next, please. In terms of understanding people's perception of risk, we asked how much risk people felt they were at when they generally had condomless anal sex. And you can see here in the green, purple, and blue that the vast majority felt that they were either somewhat or at higher risk of HIV infection when they were having sex without a condom. Their perception of risk among participants was higher if they did report an STI in the year before the study, but it didn't differ if they reported drug use. Next, please. So in summary, the PROUD study enrolled participants who were a median age that is similar to the age at which we see gay men being newly diagnosed with HIV in this country. They were highly educated, predominantly employed, clearly already engaged with sexual health clinics, and clearly many were already using PEP for HIV prevention. In comparison to other UK data, participants reported higher rates of condomless anal sex partners, STIs, PEP use, and drug use. Next, please. The large majority of participants did perceive themselves at risk, and this was significantly higher among those who had STIs, so there was a good comprehension of risk-taking. And at enrollment, people were clearly using a range of risk reduction strategies that, as I say, appeared to be polarized between condoms or sero-sorting. So the PROUD study very clearly attracted gay men who were at suitably high risk of HIV to benefit from PrEP, and it is by enrolling this higher risk group than we'd usually see in sexual health clinics that we've been able to address this question of effectiveness. Next, please. So in terms of what the next steps are now, we are in the process of collecting HIV and STI results from all participants and are working towards releasing the results in the first quarter of next year. We're working towards a submission. It's a late breaker, so a late submission to the CROI conference early next year, and hopefully a Lancet publication around the same time. The community organisations in the UK released a position statement on PrEP in 2012, and they're in the process of updating that on the basis of our finding. And Beaver and Bash are also planning to revise their position statement. There is an NHS clinical reference group that's set up in September to work towards developing a PrEP policy for the UK, and they were working towards being able to present that in 2016, and we're very hopeful that that plan might be available sooner given the results from this study. The pilot study is ongoing, and we will continue to follow people up until April 2016 and continue to collect important data on adherence and any changes in risk behavior among that population. And we had put in a funding application for a larger trial to answer the question of effectiveness, but that is answered. So we're in the process of consulting on what are the next highest priority questions for HIV prevention in the UK. So that is a summary of the trial to date. The last two slides, if Kevin could just flick through, just reflect our acknowledgements of our thanks to study participants and the clinics and steering committees involved with the study. Thank you.
Thanks, Missy. That's, I think, one of the clearest presentations I've ever heard on a webinar. That was brilliant. Really going through a lot of data really clearly. Thanks very much. I think that gives people a really good sort of idea about how the trial's been conducted and what it's found so far. I'm going to give 2 minutes just for people to have questions specifically about Mitzi's presentation and anything that arises right now. So has anyone got any questions? If you have, unmute yourself by pressing *7. Okay, I have one myself, Mitzi. I kind of know the answer, but I'm asking it on behalf of participants. The application for the new trial, what's the timeline on that? Where has it got to, or the expanded trial?
Mm-hmm. So we had applied at the beginning of this year to do a larger trial of Truvada. We got invited to do the full application in August, and we should have heard the outcome this month in terms of whether we would have got the funding to expand. Because of the timing of the announcement from the pilot study, we've been asked to resubmit a new trial application, revising it for new priorities, and to submit that in January. There's a commitment to fast-track that process, but I'm not totally clear on exactly what that will mean for the timeline, but it certainly means that we would not be in a position to open up for any more enrollment probably until very late next year, more likely early 2016, even if we are successful.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. All right. Okay, any more questions? By the way, if you don't hear questions, it doesn't mean people are not interested, because in my experience, we don't get a lot of questions on these webinars. A lot of people are there and are listening. I've had several emails from people just saying, I'm here. But do please ask questions if you have them, and if you're thinking of questions, then do email me or just type them in the panel on the presentation window. Okay, I'm now going to ask Daniela Rojas Castro from AID, my French pronunciation, to talk about the IPERGE trial. Daniela is another social scientist and psychologist, and has worked since 2008 as the community-based researcher coordinator at AIDS, which is the largest HIV NGO in France. And since 2012, she's also been a researcher at Social Psychology Research Group in the University of Lyon 2. Her research background relates to health behaviour and its social determinants, influences, and has been very active in the area of HIV prevention amongst MSM and in, of HIV-positive people, and has worked with other groups, importantly, such as injection drug users and migrants, because obviously one of the other unanswered questions about PrEP is what the need is in other groups other than gay men, especially in a very varied epidemic such as in Europe. Anyway, Daniela, we would love to hear you present about If You're Gay and your work with it. And if you're not, and please unmute yourself by pressing star 7 and talk to us about it.
Yes?
Yes, we can hear you. We can.
Hello to everybody. First of all, I would like to thank you for inviting me today to present our experience with the Iberger trial, and more in detail to present the benefits of involving communities in PrEP trials and real-life experience. Next, please. When I received your invitation, I spent quite a lot of time deciding what information I should share with you during these 12 minutes. So, should I present scientific data or information regarding our experience inside the trial that produces scientific data? I asked for all the presentations already existing concerning Iberger results, and then I realized that scientific data is available, and I am pretty sure that you already know these results even better than me. So I made up my mind, and I choose to talk about the things that happened before, during, and then will happen after the Iberger trial. This is quite important for us because the community experience regarding Iberger is not published yet, and it is not as available as probably existing data. And from our point of view, it's fundamental to understand the Iberger experience and particularly the Iberger result. This issue brings me to another interesting point. As you know, AIDS, the community-based association where I do work, is a scientific member of the Iberger trial. This membership has been sometimes criticized. We are aware, and I would say better than anyone, of the complexity of this double position, and we can come back to this issue later. In any case, what I wanted to state is that I am speaking today as a researcher involved in this trial, as an individual who has his own opinion regarding PrEP, as a CBO representative. Next, please. This slide has the objective of stating some benchmarks in the recent French story regarding PrEP. I will not describe all, but as you can see, in 2009, our board of directors took the decision to participate in the Iberger trial. And then a survey was conducted to know the willingness of MSM to participate in this trial, as well as to describe their sexual needs. In 2010, a community-based organization was conducted by the 30 Phantom, and in 2012, Iberger was launched. In 2013, a working group started to reflect on the practical considerations of an open-level PrEP, who, where, why, and what evaluation of this open-level use. These are some of the points that are going to inspire the flash PrEP survey that I present later. Next, please. Let me present you briefly the community consultation conducted by the Terre des Cinq in 2010. More than 300 people participated in this consultation that took place in 10 French cities. The arrival of the Iberger trial and the conduction of this consultation was clearly perceived as an opportunity to work together not only all the HIV-AIDS associations, but also the LGBT associations, in some cases, details of health issues. It was also an opportunity to inform about new prevention tools and about prevention research, at the same time that an opportunity to mobilize gay men on the HIV prevention issue. Besides, it was clear that informing community and exchanging with them was absolutely necessary before and during the trial conception. Lots of discussions and debates took place. Did the project fit people needs? Were their interests respected? Were researchers and funding agencies aware that without communities' adhesion, such a trial had no sense? What were the objectives of HyperGay? Was HyperGay feasible? What kind of information the community expected to be delivered? What implementation should be done? And how the gay community will be involved? These are some of the questions that were discussed during this community consultation. Next slide. This consultation had to be done, and discussion was possible. Nevertheless, there were some limits that deserve to be mentioned. Regarding the process, there was not enough time to conduct properly this consultation, neither during the meetings, neither for the whole implementation process. This lack of time did not allow going further, and the level of information regarding PrEP after the consultation was still low. Besides, when we see who participates in this consultation, we can say that it was more an associative consultation instead of a community consultation. As for the content, we observed that the difference between PrEP as a tool and PrEP in the research setting was still not clear. Finally, the very purpose of the consultation was not clear. Were we informing and consulting, or we were mobilizing and recruiting? In any case, it is our perception that this consultation was, in somehow, a debate among activists that was not necessarily able to build a long-term process regarding PrEP. Next, please. And then HyperGay arrives. Next, please. And we actively participated, becoming a scientific partner of the trial. Why we invested so much in this trial? For several reasons. From our point of view, PrEP was a means to fulfill a need of gay men exposed to HIV. In the second place, our participation was a means to ensure counseling and coaching regarding sexual health. Third, we could integrate a psychosocial approach to a quiet biomedical project. This psychosocial approach is more close to our daily work since its object is sexual behavior and social determinants of behavior. In the fourth place, research is a way of changing society, of changing the laws. And HyperGay was a European project that could have an impact on the future of an open level access in Europe. Finally, and as you can read on the slide, there were also potential benefits of an intermittent schema in comparison with a continuous PrEP. We must keep in mind that this intermittent schema focuses on behaviors. The person is going to have sex instead of a prescription. You have to take the pill 5 days a week because the doctor says so. Next slide. I am sure that you know perfectly the design of HyperGay, so I will pass quickly on this slide. This important information is that we recruit MSM declaring high-risk sexual behavior during the last 6 months and with a correct kidney function.
Hello, Daniela. Just a little time warning. You've got about 5 minutes. You're presenting wonderfully, but just to make you aware of the time, okay?
Okay. People were assigned to one of the two existing arms. 950 people were expected to enter in each arm. Next, please. The schema regarding tablets was the following. 2 tables in between 2 or 24 hours before sex, then 1 pill 24 hours after sex, and then 1 pill 48 hours after sex. Next slide. Here you will find a graph that describes what happens around the appointments in HyperGay trials. I know that this is not an easy graph, but I would like you to focus on the light blue box in the middle of the graph. That's what the medical setting provides: STI consultations, adherence measure, vaccination, blood sample. If you focus now on the rest of the graph, you will see what's the role of community peers participating in the HyperGay trial. At this very moment, there are 10 community peers that are in charge of recruiting and supporting men participating in the HyperGay trial. They will have the first contact with them to explain the trial. They will provide with a sexual health counseling. They will be available if the participant has a question, a doubt, or needs to clarify a sexual health-related issue. Besides, they conduct focus groups in order to facilitate exchanges among the IPRA participants. If we have such good results regarding adherence and consequently efficacy, it's closely related to this individualized sexual health coaching that has been proposed throughout IPRGET TRI. This coach helps participants to develop an individualized health improvement plan. We should strongly keep this information in mind because this experience will not be easy to replicate in the real life setting. And it would be naive to believe that IPRGET efficacy results are only due to Truvada. Next, please. Recently, Proud announced its decision of stopping the deferred arm, and this information was determinant to us to the IPRGET Independent Monitoring Board to analyze our data. The Independent Monitoring Board found that the number of HIV cases in the Truvada arm was significantly lower than the placebo arm, leading to the decision to stop the placebo arm. Community peers and participants were informed of these results before the press release, and they warmly welcome this consideration. As for community peers, the announcement of this breaking news was particularly emotive. After years of work, of criticisms in some cases, they felt proud of recognizing their role as community peers in this trial. Regarding the impact of this news, we must say that there were no main reactions. I mean, we found positive echoes, but this was not really huge. It was like evident to everybody about these results. Next, please. And then we conduct this survey, the flashback survey. Next, please. This survey had two main objectives: to characterize the HIV negative people awareness regarding PrEP, the willingness to take PrEP, and the current intention to use PrEP. We also wanted to characterize the informal PrEP use. Next, please. I will only describe here three main results, but there is a lot more to come. The third result is that among the 3,024 respondents, only 33% were aware of what PrEP is before filling in the questionnaire. There is still a lot of work to do regarding information. As for the intention to use PrEP in a global health setting, we found that the factors associated to this intention were being a migrant, being a heterosexual man, being an informal PrEP user, and belonging to the most at-risk populations. Finally, almost 5% of the respondents declared having used informal PrEP. 75% of them were MSM, but 25% were heterosexual men and women. Next, please. And what are the next steps? First of all, to continue our national advocacy strategy, we are advocating for including as much men as possible in the open label extension of IPRGET. But above all, we will advocate for obtaining an open label use of PrEP for all the populations at risk, and this includes not only MSM, but also migrants, sex workers, transgender, etc. Since we are aware that informal PrEP use exists, we are going to ask to the Medical Association to establish guidelines regarding this fact. Finally, we will do a lot of efforts to bring value to the work done by the community peers in IPRGET, since any service providing PrEP in the future should be inspired by this model already evaluated and highly efficient. As for European advocacy strategy, we expect that the European CDC will take a position regarding PrEP, and we will be happy to collaborate with you, of course. Finally, we will disseminate the results of the flash PrEP survey as much as possible among health policymakers. We would like this data to be taken into consideration when the target, the design, and the place to deliver PrEP in the next future will be established. Next, please. Thanks a lot for your attention.
Great. I really like your community survey. That's got some very interesting results already. In a country like France, where PrEP is not available, I find about a third of people being aware of PrEP, quite a high proportion. Can I ask you, how did you recruit people to the survey? Who is this representing, as it were?
Yeah, we asked to fulfill a paper questionnaire to all the people who are coming to our activity, but we did also an internet survey in order to have other kind of population. So we had 1,000 people who came to aid, who answered, and then 2,000 people who answered by the internet.
Okay. Okay, so some will already have known about PrEP anyway from being involved in your focus groups and things. Okay, has anyone else got any questions resulting immediately from Daniela's presentation? Just as a general comment, I think that's great because that shows the amount of preparation that has gone into IBAGAY. And certainly, I mean, Mitzi didn't talk about this, but we did quite a lot of community discussions and meetings before we got crowd together as well, because these are trials which need to be sort of embedded within the communities that are serving them. It's not about sort of recruiting people from hospitals and stuff. And so I think that's a sort of lesson for PrEP trials in ongoing, and also a model for how people might be outreached to who need PrEP. Okay,
Kevin, we're getting some questions on the interface, and so
could you ask them, because I'm not getting them.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's why I'm bringing it to you. That's why.
Okay,
I'm
good.
So, one is, can the two presenters share some information about adherence to both studies? And then there's a question about how informal PrEP users get a hold of Truvada.
Okay.
Can they use other ARVs?
Okay. Very briefly, I'd like you to comment on what you know about adherence. I think Daniela did briefly show... Oh, no, that was about retention. I'll leave the one about informal PrEP through to the question and answer session at the end, because Damon and Greg may have comments on that too. So what do you know about... what do we know about adherence so far in PROUD and in IBAGAY?
So in PROUD, our last trial steering committee, the report was that self-reported adherence was over 90%, so very high self-reported. We are doing small numbers of drug level of blood tests to see drug levels in the blood, and we are only taking blood from individuals who have reported high adherence. And all of those tests, I think there's been about 15 so far, have corresponded with high levels of reported adherence.
And Daniela, do you know much about reported adherence or in IBAGAY?
Well, what I can say is that we had high adherence results, and they were presenting in Melbourne, so I can send you, if you want, the PowerPoint point.
Yes, I think I reported on the adherence from Melbourne, and it was very high, and that's from drug level monitoring as well. The interesting question in IBAGAY, because it is a study of intermittent PrEP, of what's been called two pills before and two in hand, and 2 days after sex, is what people's patterns of taking PrEP were, and whether some were effectively taking it daily, whether some were taking it several times a week, and whether some were only taking it once or twice a month, and whether efficacy was different between those two. Do you know, you might not know, whether you're going to be able to sort of tease those statistics out? Because it's important to find out people's patterns of use.
Regarding the patterns of use of Truvada, what I can say at this point is that we know that about 4% were using a PrEP continuously.
Sorry, how many was that? It just cut out then.
Sorry?
Sorry, what was the number? It just cut out, I think.
We are at more than 400, but we are not able to provide this information yet.
Okay.
So I can give the percentage, but no the numbers.
Yeah, so how many were using PrEP continuously?
Among 4 or 5% were using.
Oh, 4 or 5%.
Yeah.
It just cut out at that point. Okay. All right, thanks. All right, well, thanks very much. Time for more questions at the end, including the one about informal PrEP, which I won't forget. Okay, now I'm introducing Damon L. Jacobs. Okay, 1 second. I've just managed to lose your bio, Damon. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Thanks, Gus. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, loud and clear.
All right. Well, thank you, Gus, for including me. Good afternoon, everyone. Good morning for those in New York and earlier. My name is Damon Jacobs. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist in New York, as well as licensed in California. And I also am very active in terms of providing education and training for trained people, healthcare organizations, and agencies about implementing PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, through in their service. And that came about kind of in my own activism, in my own voice. I'm not affiliated with any organization at all at this point, but just with this passion for people to learn about PrEP, because once we started seeing that here, there wasn't a lot of education happening about it. So I just want to go a little bit, if we can look at the first slide, or the next slide, to talk about some of the history, because the thing I get asked constantly is, why can't people just use condoms? What's wrong with condoms? Why aren't gay men using condoms or bisexual men using condoms? And I like to go back to kind of the earlier days of how we prevented this epidemic. I began working in this field in 91. And back then we knew that if everybody used a condom 100% of the time, if everybody who is HIV positive, everybody who is HIV negative, tops and bottoms, if everybody or whatever they were doing used a condom, we would have no new infections by the year 2000. And that was the goal, 100%. And it made sense, right? I mean, sure, on a scientific level, that made a lot of sense. But what happened? Next slide. Next slide. Nope. Okay. So what happened was, despite our best efforts, condom use did not stay consistent. And basically, even when the consequences, as they were in the early 90s, tragically enough, that the consequences of not using a condom meant that someone could get AIDS. We called it AIDS then, not HIV. That someone could get AIDS and potentially die. That people were still not using condoms consistently. And what this shows is through our CDC is that you can see here that the level of new infections in the U.S. did drop considerably once we understood the science behind condom use. And then it kind of leveled off. And around 2003, 2002, it has remained the same in the United States. We have about 50,000 new infections every year, give or take. And that is despite all of our efforts in terms of telling people to use condoms and all of our efforts in terms of getting people to comply with antiretrovirals. New infections have not drastically changed. But what happened exactly 4 years ago today, November 24th, was that we received the news from the IPREX study. And the first headline in that series was the 44% number that was presented earlier today, that if people in IPREX overall, on average, risk reduction was 44% in the IPREX study. But then another fact came out a few months later, and that was that people who took Truvada consistently, 7 days, or I believe it's 5 or 6 days a week, seemed to have greater than 92% protection from HIV. And that when people used Truvada consistently for PrEP, they were significantly at reduced risk, even close to zero risk for becoming infected with HIV. With that information, our Food and Drug Administration, FDA, approved Truvada to be used for prevention so that all insurances and state Medicaid systems here would pay for it and private insurances would pay for it. And I thought, great, here we are. We're finally at this point where we're going to see an impact in new infections because this is a really big deal. We have this new tool, and we still have condoms for those who prefer to use condoms, and some people prefer both. But I thought, great, now it's 2012, July 16th, the FDA approved it. This is going to be great. And nothing really happened. There was very little coverage. There was very little conversation. There was very little media conversation. And for someone who has been working in the field for this long to see such little attention paid to such an important measure was very frustrating. So I started going public, and I started writing about this, and I started going online and was invited to our Huffington Post Live to do a talk about that, which resulted in the following slide. Go to the next slide, please. So immediately following the appearances that I started doing at the end of 2012 came the backlash, and that came through the Huffington Post, which was called Truvada Whores. And this name really started to stick in terms of the labeling and the shaming and the attacking that I and anybody who was using PrEP and openly talking about our own personal use of pre-exposure prophylaxis started dealing with. The Truvada Whores movement, per se, as a stigmatizing term, really caught on. And you can see a lot in social media, in different boards, that this became the attack label du jour. So one of the ways that I decided to combat that and deal with that was to start a group on Facebook, not only because I'm a big fan of Facebook, but I also, at that in July of 2013, if you looked on Facebook, you would see that there was nothing at that time readily available for anyone in terms of seeing education, information about PrEP. And because there was so little at that time, I wanted to do something on some level to help people learn and understand the implications of PrEP. So I started this group page, and that led me to the next slide. On July 1st, 2013, I started this international group called PrEP Facts, Rethinking HIV Prevention and Sex, which I hope all of you will join, and I hope all of you who are on Facebook will decide to visit. And it became an opportunity for anybody in the world to get to see the science, the research, the opinions, the debates, the facts, the tools for discussing PrEP with their doctors, because most people, especially a year ago, but I think this is still the case, we're the first people going to their doctors asking for this and did not know how to talk to them, did not know how to approach them and to deal with the doctor's stigma, which a lot of people receive. A lot of people on my page are getting support for adherence and understanding how to stay adherent to PrEP using different apps, using different tools, the skills for confronting stigma from family and friends. They're getting friendship, they're getting community, and occasionally they get a date. That happens too. Next slide. And so when it comes to talking about PrEP, and I'm just going to zoom through this, and you can look at the slide or you'll be able to see the slide later, but what I basically do when I talk to healthcare workers and do trainings, why are people using PrEP? Why aren't people using condoms? Why are our patients asking for this? It's for all the reasons that I spell out with the acronym PLEASURE, because we don't want to forget that piece, charts and graphs and numbers and science, that's really great and that's really important. But let's not forget the reason why people are taking this medication. It's to enhance pleasure, peace of mind, living without fear, with the expectation that we'll stay HIV negative, with the sense of agency that I have control over my body, with the satisfying sex that comes from using pleasure, with the sense of unity that's not being divided by HIV status any longer, the sense of responsibility that comes from taking PrEP, and efficacy for bottoms, because for people that choose to be the receptive anal sex partner, this is the very, very first time that they have the ability to remain 100% HIV negative and to have that control, instead of relying on the top partner to wear the condom and make sure it doesn't fall off or fall in or break. This is the very first time receptive bottoms have had an opportunity to be 100% in control of their HIV status. That was a lot of information I just blew through, so I just want to encourage people, if you have any questions about this, please feel free to follow up with me at Damon@DamonLJacobs.com, or Gus has my information, or come visit the Facebook group. I'd love to hear more feedback and have more discussions about these issues. All right, Gus, that's your cue.
Okay, can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Yep. Yes, I found it. I found Damon's bio. One statistic he missed out, his Facebook group now has 4,500 members, and I know that this is one of the most, probably the best example I know of the use of a social media group to generate community discussion, education, and activity. And so I think he's done a terrific job in the US. as part of the sort of general kind of raising of awareness and support for people using PrEP. And on a personal note, I would certainly have benefited from it had it been around in 1985 or something. Anyway, that's in the States, where, of course, PrEP has been licensed, approved, since 2012, and it's extraordinary to see how much discussion has been on it since. We are some way behind in Europe, and that's why I wanted somebody who had taken PrEP in Europe to come and talk to us about it. And so we've got Greg Mitchell, whose bio is brief but intriguing. Says, Greg is formerly an adult model, now a tantric masseur and writer for the Gay UK. I think he's modest there, he's a very good writer, and as part of the proud study he's been on PrEP for just over a year. Greg, you haven't got any slides, I know. You've only got about 6 minutes because we do need to leave a bit of time for questions, and I have several questions that people have flagged through to me. But if you just want to talk about your motivation for joining the proud study, what the experience has been like, and your general feelings about PrEP in Europe.
Okay, can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Yep, it's good. Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm not a health professional, and this is just a personal view of my own about my experience of taking PrEP and reactions to it within the gay community in the UK. Most reactions being that very few people seem to know about it, although more people are beginning to as we're starting to write about it. And I got to write about it because I saw an article actually in my own magazine, The Gay UK, which I found extremely negative and inaccurate on several points. So I wrote in response to that, and that was the first time that I really started to get involved, because before then I hadn't realized it was so controversial, nor had I realized that so many people were violently against it. So for me, coming out about taking PrEP has resulted in some pretty negative comments from other people in the community. I've been called a whore, I've been called irresponsible, selfish, slut. Many of the attacks coming from people I've never met, but very, very personal. It doesn't exactly bother me, but it surprises me that people are so violently opposed to it. Because, interestingly, when I actually talk to straight friends and to my family about what I was doing, the reactions were really positive, and all of them were saying, my God, what a fantastic breakthrough. And I found it really hard to understand why I was not, or why so many gay men were not reacting in the same way. And I think it does come from the still deep-seated shame surrounding sex. Gay sex is still, to a degree, considered shameful. And condom-free sex has become even more shameful. And I don't want to use the word barebacking, because barebacking itself is a loaded term and only came into being in the post-HIV generation. Before that, we didn't have bareback sex. We just had sex. And it wasn't dirty. It wasn't unnatural. It was just normal sex. It's not shameful. And I keep trying to remind people that why we started using condoms in the first place and why they get so upset about it, I just don't understand it. So when I tell some younger guys that no gay man ever used a condom before HIV come along, they look at me as if I'm mad. But given the fact that HIV infections are still on the increase, gay men are still not using condoms all the time, as Damon said. And even though they think they should, they aren't doing it. And it's not because they're drunk or high, but it's just borne out in Mitzi's report. It's because it simply feels better. And I know there's a question of other STDs, but aside from the fact that they are for the most part easily treatable, you can still get chlamydia and gonorrhea if you're using condoms. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day about it, and he was absolutely opposed to PrEP, and he brought up the topic of other STDs again. But then, although he's somebody who said he always has protected sex using condoms, and actually I've had sex with him and I know that we did, he said, oh, the last time he was at the clinic he got chlamydia, so it kind of scuppered his argument. But what I'd like to say is that I consider that by doing PrEP, I'm still having safer sex. And this is the thing that we don't seem to be able to get across to people. And I think one of the other things that also surprised me when I went public about doing PrEP is that it uncovered within our community the stigma that still surrounds HIV, and that came as a big shock to me. It seemed to me that some still had the attitude that the only gay guys getting HIV these days are the dirty gay guys. That's the ones who go to sex parties and they sleep around and they probably deserve it. That's the attitude that was prevalent. But we know, I mean, research tells us that in actual fact it's usually the primary partner that is responsible for somebody's HIV infection. So there is a gap between what people do and what they say they do. People are rarely honest, even to themselves, about their sex life. So, but for me, personally, going on to PrEP has been a revelation because it has removed anxiety. I think that's the most important thing, and it's one of the things that Damon talked about in his presentation. You can't believe until it happened to you what it's like to have that anxiety removed. Because even on the occasions when I'd had unprotected sex with somebody, after proper consultation with each other, we talked about it, there's always in the back of your mind that last vestige of doubt of maybe somebody could pass it on to somebody else. And with anxiety gone, it is a liberating factor in one's sex life. I can't tell you what a difference that has made. And that surely is the great thing about it. This is me taking responsibility for my own sexual health. And yet I'm being judged for taking control. I don't get it. You know, I'm a good subject. I know I take my pill every day. I know that that it suits me that way rather than the IPREP study because my sex life is not very organized. So for me, taking one pill a day is the best thing that could happen. And really, that's about all I want to say. You know, I'm not a statistician. It's my personal response to it. And I think what we need to do now in the community is get that message out to people so that they start to let go the idea that sex without condoms is shameful and dirty. I think that's as much as I need to say.
Okay. Hello, this is Gus here. Thanks, Paul. Greg, that's brilliant. I know why I said Paul. I'm just replying to a friend of mine by email who had a question. I hope there'll be... now we've got 15 minutes for discussion. I think what you said is so important, that people like us who are kind of HIV treatment specialists and, you know, talk to the researchers and things like that, and we use the kind of the sort of the facts and the data, and we kind of know what the implications of them are and so on. But your average gay guy on the scene isn't necessarily interested in grasping all that. What he wants to know is sort of the basic facts about this this thing and whether it might be suitable for him. And, of course, it's not suitable for everybody. If people have no problems with condoms, then PrEP's not for them. But, I mean, it's such... But condom use is not adhered to by even necessarily a majority of gay men 100%. So this is a really important additional HIV prevention method. Anyway, I have a few questions through already, and I flagged up one already, which is a question about what are people's impressions, given what Daniela said about informal PrEP use. I think it was 4.5% of your respondents said they'd used PrEP informally. Damon, Greg, what, and also others, what's your impression about kind of, you know, are people swapping Truvadas on the dance floor to sort of caricature it?
We hear about these, what they're called like disco dosing on the dance floor. I don't have any personal knowledge of that, but people do discuss that on the page that you mentioned with the international Facebook page. You know, I think we need to, I feel like in my responsibility is that I'm just very careful. I don't tell people what to do, but I certainly recommend people follow the guidelines that we now understand, which at this moment is that daily dosing is the most effective way to prevent HIV, and that the results from EPRK are still being studied and they're still being understood and may or may not be the best way to do that. My biggest concern that I share is that if people are disco dancing and are already HIV positive and don't...
I think disco dancing is all right, Jacob.
Disco dancing, disco dosing.
I think you mean different
Truvada without, and they're already HIV positive and do not know that they're already HIV positive, that they could develop resistance to Truvada. And that is really my biggest concern right now about casual use, sporadic use that's done without a medical provider.
Yes. Mitzi, you still... Greg, yes, go on.
Yeah, no, which is why, obviously, education is so important, because unless people are actually told how the medication works, then you are going to have instances of this kind of thing happening, because they don't really understand it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mitzi, if you're still there,
yep.
One of the questions I see quite repeated quite often in Damon's page, and this is a complex question, I know we don't necessarily know the answer fully, is sort of how soon will my PrEP start working after I start taking it? And I think this is of a lot of concern for guys, and obviously is to do with the question that we've just been asking.
Mm-hmm. So in PROUD, we say to people that you need to be using it daily for 2 weeks to come to a steady state of dosing. I have seen different time periods reported in different places, but we say 2 weeks and then maintain dosing of at least 4 tablets a week. The evidence suggests that that will be sufficient to offer protection.
Okay. So there may well be a lead-in, and you don't just take a pill and you're protected is the sort of message we need to be sending out to people. I mean, that's why in Ipagay it was quite it was 2 pills before and 2 pills in the 2 days afterwards. It was to try and make sure that people's levels were high enough.
That's true, but on our basis of 2 weeks lead-in, I mean, there is a chance that the Ipagay system of that, so that will be very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, this isn't a completely settled research question in my, as far as I can tell. Okay, I have a question specifically for Daniela. Somebody's asking, what news is there? Obviously, we've heard that there's still moves to extend PROUD. Are the moves to extend Ipagay still going on? For instance, it was going to go into Berlin and things like that.
I didn't understand the question.
I know that Ipagay was planning to expand into other sites.
Yes.
For instance, Berlin was mentioned as well.
Yeah.
Is this still going to happen?
Now we are discussing, because we had a Gates funding for this, and the negotiations were based on the old protocol, and since now we have stopped the placebo arm, we are renegotiating to open the site. So it's in discussion.
Is it? Hello. Is that somebody speaking? Hello?
Hello, I'm here.
Yes, I have a question.
Okay, well, hang on, wait a minute. There's some sort of interference.
Oh, I need to try.
Hello? I think somebody's trying to speak in the background, but you're either... Hello?
Yes, I was trying to ask a question, but I did this wrong, I think. I'm sorry.
No, I can hear you. There was somebody else, I think, also trying to answer a question, but we couldn't hear a word because I think you were on speakerphone. Anyway, thanks for... Who is the person who's trying to ask a question who I can hear?
My name is Harold.
Yep, hello. Yes.
My question is, why is it that they, since there are other STIs that you can catch, perhaps that they don't add herpes prophylaxis when they prescribe PrEP?
Okay, that's an interesting question, and Kevin already flagged that one up. Any comments on that? Could we combine PrEP with some other kinds of STI prophylaxis? Perhaps Mitzi might have a go at that one. You still there, Mitzi? Don't forget to unmute yourself.
Can you hear me now?
Sorry.
I was talking away. Okay, so there is a lot of talk about combination products. for both HIV and STIs, and for women around HIV and contraceptive products. There are a lot of barriers to it because companies are very reluctant to offer a drug that hasn't been confirmed as effective for a specific indication, like HIV prevention, to be combined with something else unless both have been confirmed as effective. So I think with the evidence that we've got around Truvada, we're in a better position to start moving that research agenda forward, but there is still a long way to go.
Okay. Yes, I mean, I think the wider answer is that for some STIs it's just not practical because you don't want to be putting antibiotics into PrEP for reasons we're probably all aware of in terms of resistance and things like that. But it might work for some other ones, but we need to investigate that. This brings in a wider question, which one of my colleagues asked me. We've only been talking about gay men in this webinar. And sorry, there's a lot of background noise, so if there is background noise, could you mute yourself with star six? Thanks. The annual report on HIV in England has just come through, showing that there's still very high levels of HIV infection within the African community, for instance, and lots of people not being diagnosed, lots of people not coming forward for testing. What are people's thoughts about extending PrEP to people outside the gay community? This is a sort of free-for-all, but clearly gay men are not the only people who need it in any country, and certainly obviously not globally. Anyone got any thoughts on that one? Remember to unmute yourself, star seven.
So it's Mitzi here. I think
we're still suffering from this background, guys. Yeah. That's better. Thank you very much, whoever it was. Yes, Mitzi.
So I think it's going to be a really important issue, and if there is an increased push for access to PrEP in the UK, that can't exclude heterosexual women and men. Certainly, it's available to heterosexual women and men in the U.S. as well. Well, on the guideline, I think the wording of availability is always questionable. But so I think it is an issue that we're going to have to address, and I think we need to start addressing that with more social science work with communities to understand some of the issues around access, restrictions to HIV testing, and understanding some of the dialogue that go on around HIV. Some of that work's been done in Scotland by Ingrid Young, but we are yet to do it in England. Mm. And I think it's an important priority.
Daniela, have you been doing work with communities other than the gay community? Star 7, if you're still there. Hello?
Can you hear? Hi?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, you were asking about the including other populations. Or
yes, whether you've been doing any work on PrEP in other populations.
Yeah, in our case, the results of our survey was a very good surprise because we expected some refusal from our health policy makers regarding to an open label for only for gay men, because that was the idea. And thinking that there are other populations that are at risk and that will be willing and who have the intention to get PrEP is going to facilitate our work in advocacy. So it's a very good thing. Now the question is how we are going to mobilize these communities. We had experience with the gay community. This wasn't easy. So now we have to do how we're going to do that with migrants, with injecting drug users, etc. We have to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. And Damon, I think there's already quite a few PrEP prescriptions going to women in the States, isn't that right? I've heard a survey that certainly in terms of the like prescriptions by primary care physicians, there's quite a few were prescribing PrEP to women. Is that true? Are you unmuting yourself?
Okay, how about now?
Yes.
Okay, well, I was trying to get in there. Yeah, we know, what we do know about PrEP prescriptions in the U.S., especially initially, is that about half, or a little less than half, were going to women in the United States, that half of the original PrEP prescriptions in the first year since it was passed by the FDA were written for women. What we have also found is that it's often difficult or more difficult to get women to talk openly about it than gay men. A lot of gay men are pretty open about sex here and just, you know, talking about Truvada and PrEP despite the stigma. But for a lot of women, there seems to be an additional stigma because they're carrying a stigma not only for themselves, but generally for their HIV-positive partner. And especially in the southern regions of the U.S. where there's still incredible stigma around HIV, women have not been as forthcoming and open to talk about using PrEP the way many gay men have in metropolitan areas. But there certainly are and have been in the U.S. women who have implemented and used PrEP consistently and, as far as we know, successfully.
All right. Well, thank you, guys. As usual, we run out of time before every question gets asked. I'd just like to say if any of you presenters or audience members have some final comments to make. We have about a minute or two left. So has anyone got anything burning that they really want to add?
Uh-oh. I just want to encourage people, again, if they have any questions, they can email me at damonljacobs.com or come visit the PrEP page. I'd love to have everybody come visit.
Well, I've had your PrEP page up, Damon, and I've already seen two people who are on the call join your page.
Wonderful.
So
oh,
it's happening.
Good.
Gus, it's Mitzi here. I've certainly just joined it, Damon. Thank you. But I also just want to flag that there is a group called U.S. Women and PrEP Working Group that is facilitated by Dayton Dixon, who's done some incredible work with Sister Love. And that's an important group in terms of thinking about access for PrEP for other groups. And I know that some groups here are starting conversations with them about thinking through those issues in the UK.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, thanks, guys. This webinar, the presentations, will be available on the AVAC website and the I think the EATG website, and we'll send the addresses through. Although we've had a few technical problems, we hope to have a sound file, a recording of the webinar up there too. Please can I remind participants that if you haven't already registered your interest in the community and researchers meeting we're having on biomedical prevention in January in Brussels, 23rd, 24th, to register your interest now. Damon and Greg are certainly invited as speakers. We will have other people from Proud and from IPEG talking. In fact, the two principal researchers, Sheena McCormack and Jean-Michel Molina, which we're very excited about. Not everyone will be able to get to the January meeting. I'm saying this to avoid disappointment because it's already oversubscribed, but of course if you don't ask, you're not going to get there. And thanks very much for your very interesting questions. Thanks for the presenters for some really nice, clear presentations. You will get, or you may already have, a little feedback form flashing up for participants, so please do complete that. So thanks very much again. And the next webinar is on Friday, December the 10th. Is that right, Rebecca? I haven't got the date in front of me. Is she there?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I have it down. I thought I had it down on the
Friday the 12th.
Friday the 12th, beg your pardon. Friday the 12th at 2 p.m. And we've got a really stellar lineup for that one. We're talking about microbicides and about vaccines. We've got Jose Esparza, who until recently headed the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's vaccine section. We have Zita Rosenberg, who is Chief Executive of the International Partnership for Microbicides. And we have Robin Shattuck, who is Chair of the EU CHAR Microbicides Consortium. And that's pretty stellar lineup. So please come along and hear about, I suppose, the more exciting future side, because PrEP and teeth treatments prevention are not the only things that we're considering for HIV prevention. So it's an exciting and fast-moving world at the moment. So thank you very much, and we look forward to hearing your feedback. Bye, guys.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.